Oh, June the 12th, 1817. A machine was invented that changed the world in many ways. Susan B. Anthony once said, it did more to emancipate women than anything else. And indeed, the bicycle challenged the status quo in many ways and continues to do so. Journalist and bike lover Jody Rosen has written an entertaining and encyclopedic history of it, Two Wheels Good, in which he looks at the evolution of the ever-saddled horse which eats nothing, as one advertisement put it, a magical machine in which the passenger is the engine, or not, as Joe Biden recently discovered. Jody Rosen's with me now. Hi, Jody.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. What was the inventor, Baron Karl von Drauss, thinking when he invented it, and what exactly did he invent?
Well, there's some question about what he was thinking. I'll tell you a little bit about him. As you say, his name was Baron Karl von Drauss. He was a minor nobleman in the Duchy of Baden in the German Federation. And this was in the year 1817. What he was doing was looking, we think, for an alternative to travel by horse, because of course in this period that was how you got around, at least how you you traveled across land in a speedy fashion was in a horse-drawn carriage or maybe on horseback. And he was trying to find a solution to an age-old problem, which is the problem of quick personal transport across land. And what he invented was in that time, a super curious machine. It was a machine which, instead of lining up two wheels on either side of an axle, he put one in front of the other. This was kind of the crucial insight. And he attached them with some wood and iron, a sort of saddle, as he called it. A reference there, of course, to the horse.
Of course, and, I've never thought about that before.
Yes, yeah, that's right. The thing that you sit on a bicycle, which is attached to the seat post, is indeed a saddle. That's the terminology. But what the difference between the bicycle that was invented in 1817 and our modern bicycle, crucially, is that it lacked pedals. So this thing was propelled with a kind of ice skating motion by sort of scooting one's feet across the ground and kind of running across the ground. Karl von Drauss called it the Laufmaschine, which means the running machine. So you sort of straddled the thing and you pushed it along. There are, of course, these days, there are these things that are called balance bikes or strider bikes, which are these little wooden devices, which look very similar, which children use to learn to balance their bodies on the bike, the sort of starter bicycle. But this was in fact the design of the starter bicycle for all of us, the kind of proto bicycle invented then in the second decade of the 19th century.
There's been some suggestion that von Drauss was responding to a terrible crop shortage after the eruption of an Indonesian volcano, which led to a shortage of food for horses and therefore necessitated another way of getting around. I don't know whether anybody's confirmed that. Have you?
You know, there's some dispute about that. That is definitely a theory which has gained currency over the last couple decades since it was first put forward by a prominent bicycle scholar. The crucial thing to know about this period, the time in which this was invented, this was the year 1816 was the year without a summer in the West. So because of the explosion of that giant volcano in an Indonesian island, there was volcanic dust released into the atmosphere, and it literally dimmed the sun such that in many parts of the West, the United States, Western Europe, there were winter-like conditions throughout the summer in 1816. And some have hypothesized that it was this climatic catastrophe which caused Karl von Drauss to think about an alternative to horse-drawn travel, because there wasn't the oats, the stuff that you typically fed the horses, weren't around, and people began to think, oh gosh, we can't get around with horses. What's another means of travel? But others have argued that this hypothesis is a kind of anachronistic one, where we're projecting back into history, because after all, these days we associate the bicycle, we think of the bicycle as a kind of green machine. machine and a machine we can use to respond to our own imperiled climatic conditions. So maybe we're kind of projecting that back into history a little bit. It's still nothing that's been confirmed. One thing we do know is that Carl von Dreyse said that he was inspired by ice skating, that kind of skating motion that was used to propel his proto-bicycle, the Laufmaschine, was something that he took from watching people skate on the ice.
A few iterations between the Laufmaschine and the safety bicycle, which came along in the 1880s. Who thought that the penny farthing was a good idea and why?
Yes, the penny farthing is that wonderful Victorian, kind of high Victorian machine, which was invented in the 1870s and experienced quite a vogue then, with the giant wheel in the front and the little wheel in the back, also known as the high wheeler, of course. The reason that you had that giant wheel was because this was a direct drive machine. That is, before at this time, they hadn't yet invented the rear driven, the chain drive, which drove the rear wheel. So they needed a direct drive. That is, they hitched the pedals up directly to that giant front wheel. And you needed a bigger wheel with a bigger circumference to make each rotation of the pedals take you far enough. So it was a sort of primitive gearing system that they rigged up on that thing. As you suggest, it was a wonderful, wacky looking machine. It was a strange looking machine, but it maybe wasn't the greatest idea in terms of safety, among other things, because people were prone to doing what they at that time called taking a header, that is pitching over the handlebars and cracking their heads. It wasn't very safe. And also it was very difficult to mount, you know, it was high up in the air.
Sure. The rubber tires, were the big breakthrough, and they were first invented for bikes, not cars, as you say in your book.
No, correct. They were, there's dispute about who should get the credit for this, but the story that we're going with in any case is John Boyd Dunlop, whose name is known now worldwide because of the Dunlop Tire Company. It was he who was a Scottish-born veterinarian, of all things, who was living in Belfast at the time. His son Johnny was a great enthusiast of riding his tricycle around the streets of Belfast, but he complained that quite rightly, that this machine was poorly engineered, that the tires, the kind of hard rubber tires, made his rides uncomfortable and difficult. So it was this veterinarian who was a tinkerer and inventor in his own right, who came up with the idea of creating a tire with an air-filled sleeve, which would absorb the shock.
They were rubber before, but he put the soft button.
Right. He put the pneumatic rubber tire, that is the sleeve filled with air, inside another layer of rubber. Before that, it was just hard rubber, as if they were riding around on, like, you know, sort of a rubber bouncing ball that was directly put onto the rim of the tire. There was no air in the tire. And it was this was definitely one of a couple of crucial engineering breakthroughs, which gave us the modern safety bicycle and gave us a crucial, you know, a machine that was comfortable enough to ride and could ride fast. It was a very, very important breakthrough, along with the invention of things like the famous diamond shaped frame that we now see. And the safety bike gave us the bicycle with two equal sized wheels instead of that giant wheel in the front. And, you know, you had a chain drive, which pulled, kind of dragged the rear wheel along, and that you could use the front wheel then simply to steer. This was the safety bicycle. And it was nicknamed the safety bicycle because indeed it was safe. Compared to, for instance, the penny farthing.
Yeah, for sure. Although Mark Twain was still able to write in 1886, "Get a bicycle, you won't regret it if you live."
Oh, for sure. And I mean, there's some of us who, for instance, yours truly, who rides around the streets of New York City every day, who, you know, I can relate to Mark Twain was saying, you know, 140 years ago, because it can still be perilous to ride your bike depending on the traffic conditions.
How many injuries have you sustained?
Me personally, oh my God, too many to count. I mean, right now I'm looking at my ring finger, the finger that my wedding band is on, and I've got a bulbous knuckle there because of a bicycle injury that I sustained when I was a teenager. But I've been hit and doored, as it were, by cars here in the streets of New York many times. But I'm still going. I can't imagine traveling any other way. It's the only way to go, despite the risks.
How many times have you been doored?
I think I've been doored three or four times, but one time was memorable because it really, that it knocked me off the bike right in the middle of Midtown traffic on 8th Avenue near 50th Street in Midtown Manhattan, just about the busiest part of town. And that was a bad injury. I limped away from that and had to get all sorts of treatment until I was myself again. I'll put it to you that way.
The bicycle, as you point out, has always been a lightning rod for culture wars. And back in the day, it was the horse industry versus bikes. And then the first Model T was produced in 1900 and something or other, 08. And bikes became something for children, and grown-ups drove cars. It's a strange kind of stigma that bicycles have always suffered from, isn't it?
Definitely, and especially in places like here in the United States, you know, where we're kind of car culture to the max, you know, the automobile was slower to catch on in Europe and the UK, for instance. Those were places where the bicycle continued to function as a kind of utilitarian commuter vehicle for decades after the invention of the automobile. But here in the United States, we kind of litigated by force of political will, by statute, the bicycle was severely marginalized. It was, you know, sort of driven off the road. It was de facto illegal to ride a bike in many places in the United States, most places in the United States, you know, it's certainly by the mid-century. And it was in this period that bicycle manufacturers, were looking for different markets for the bicycle, because after all, it was by this point, as you say, it was stigmatized. People were thought of, a proper adult. An adult drove a car around. So they developed this market for children's bicycles simply as a way to sell these things, to keep the bicycle industry going in this country. And that idea really took hold here and elsewhere. The idea that the bicycle is this kind of totem of childhood, but it was kind of a starter transportation vehicle. And eventually you would graduate to the real deal, to an automobile.
Somebody has just texted me to say he's just been watching stage one of the Tour de France last night. Such a technical sport with hugely expensive bikes. He wonders what the original inventor would say about what bikes have become. And in a way, the Tour de France has changed the image of bikes. You know, it's manned them up in some way, has it not?
Yeah, well, sure. I mean, the history of bicycle racing is very long. It stretches back almost to the very first bicycle, to that proto Laufmaschine. But there's definitely kind of, depending on where you are and when you are in history, there are different ideas that have kind of circulated around bikes in terms of the ideas about machismo and whether they're machines for men, whether they're machines for children. You know, it's funny because in many parts of the world, of course, you know, bicycle as sport is extremely popular. And then there are other parts of the world where the bicycle remains a utilitarian device primarily. And it's a vehicle. It's transport, not sport. I mean, a fact that is important to take on board is that there are more bicycles by a factor, by hugely many, many more bicycles than there are cars in the world. So the bicycle is kind of hidden in plain sight. There are approximately 1 billion cars in the world. There are approximately 2 billion bicycles. So in many ways, we live on a bicycle planet, whether we know it or not.
Let's look at the cycle window in a small parish church in Buckinghamshire, St. Giles. Now, this is a famous window. You went to see it, and the priest said, sure, you want to see the window. Everybody wants to see the window. And it does look remarkably like somebody sitting on a sort of a bicycle with a horn thing. And it's centuries old, this. What is it?
That's right. So what you're referring to is this kind of stained glass panel that sits in a church, the church called the Church of St. Giles in Stoke Poges in Buckinghamshire in England. The provenance of this particular stained glass piece is unknown. It's disputed, as many things are in bicycle history. But some people think it dates from 15th century Flanders. Other people think it dates to the 17th century. In any case, what it seems to depict is some sort of creature, some sort of being, maybe a cherub, astride a wheeled device, which may or may not have two wheels. It sort of, if you squint hard enough, looks like a bicycle. And that's certainly what many people took it to look like. So this whole kind of mythology developed around it, where people thought they were, when they saw that thing, they were looking at a kind of remnant of an earlier bicycling culture that, you know, dated back centuries. And this is an interesting fact about bicycles and their reception. You know, the bicycle, of course, doesn't date back centuries. It dates back, or not, certainly not 3 or 4 or 5 centuries. It dates back almost exactly 2 centuries to 1817, that we're sure of. But it seemed to arrive in the world illogically late, because the technology that you need to create a bicycle was available to humankind since the early Middle Ages. And I think that's part of the reason why people cannot seem to wrap their mind around the idea that the bicycle arrived so relatively recently in history. People cling to this idea that it has to have some ancient origins. So there's tons of kind of apocryphal stories, weird creation myths around the bicycle. People saying, oh no, the Romans had bicycles, their cavalries rode around them, or the ancient Egyptians rode around on bicycle like devices. So the bicycle window in the church in Stoke Poges is another example of this kind of all these crazy creation myths that have arisen over the centuries.
It seems a very benign thing, the bicycle, and yet less benign is its use in warfare and in colonial expansion, which you talk about. It was used in the Boer War, and the military bicycle was used by the Viet Cong, of course. I mean, it came in very handy.
Yeah, no, this is true. You know, one of the things I tried to kind of gently correct in this book is, you know, those of us who love bicycles, bicycle activists, bicycle advocates, tend to picture the bicycle as this kind of noble and ennobling device, a kind of peaceable green machine whose, you know, carbon footprint is very low, certainly compared to the automobile, and which, as the title of my book says, is good. Two wheels good, four wheels bad is one of the mantras of bike activists. And the fact is that bicycles are good, if you ask me, and I prefer to ride a bicycle around than drive a car any day. I don't drive a car. The bicycle is my primary means of transport. That said, the bicycle is a thing in the world, and like all real things in the real world, has a complicated history. And as you say, it's entangled with a lot of darker history, with the history of, in the age of empire, of colonial expansion in many places in the world. For instance, Africa, parts of Asia, Latin America, the Caribbean. The bicycle first arrived ridden by soldiers and prospectors and proselytizers, missionaries. So the bicycle's, you know, the record of the bicycle is not all, as it were, good. It's complicated. And that's a point I tried to make in various ways in the book.
Now, you herald a new global bicycle culture. But maybe the Chinese thought that was what was happening when the bike attained that cultural status back in the day, around the middle of the last century. And then suddenly the car became the new thing. And now bikes are diminishing in China. So it goes in waves. Do you think the bicycle will ever become truly established?
Yeah, it's interesting what you say. In China, they called, China was known as the kingdom of the bicycle. That was a nickname the Chinese had for their own nation. And at the height of the bicycle's kind of reign in China, there were over 500 million bikes on the roads of China. That's an astonishing number. And it was sort of a state mandated device. Deng Xiaoping, when he announced reforms, sort of reforms in the 1970s, he stated that every Chinese person should have a flying pigeon. That is, that was the kind of the biggest bicycle brand in China. So they thought of it as the bicycle as something that you just simply needed to have to be a Chinese citizen. And as you say, China has gone the way of car culture, particularly in this century. They embrace car culture in a way that even makes what we have here in the United States look like nothing. I mean, the road network they have in China is much larger than the American interstate highway system. So they have gone full bore into car culture. As for where we all are collectively globally today, well, the pandemic has brought a new bicycle boom. And, you know, people all around the world were seeking a socially distanced means of travel, a way to kind of keep their distance from people during the peak months of the pandemic in 2020, a way means of travel they couldn't get, of distance that they couldn't get on public transit, or certainly. And so the bicycle boomed across the world. There were supply chain problems, of course, and bicycle infrastructure has sprung up in cities on all six continents in the past couple of years at a rate we haven't seen before. So it's possible that we could be entering a new kind of halcyon age of the bicycle, but it really depends on whether governments are going to seize the initiative to clear cars off the roads in various ways and create bicycle infrastructure, create safe conditions for cycling, because that's what you really need to have a vibrant bicycle culture in cities. You need to be able to ride them safely. And that's something, unfortunately, that is not the case in many of the cities the world.
Here's a typical text I'm getting now. Cycling in Auckland is so bad that I've stopped cycling and I now drive to work. Some drivers are actually openly aggressive to cyclists. I saw one with an anti-cyclist bumper sticker, and when I confronted him about this, his response was, "All cyclists are gay," as if this justified his position. Mm. We've really got the macho thing going on with people driving big trucks and thinking that they own the world here. It's hard to see whether that attitude is ever going to change.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, as you say, those attitudes are deeply entrenched. There actually is, there is some social science to report what your texter is reporting anecdotally. You know, a couple of actually Australian researchers found was that in cultures that are kind of centered around cars, cyclists are subject to processes of dehumanization, and in fact are thought of by some large percentage of drivers as less than human. Now, this is a social science speaking, this isn't me editorializing. So yes, it's a tough environment. And I think, as I was saying earlier, it really depends on regulation. You know, bicycling is much better for public health, for the health of individual citizens, and for collective health, certainly for the health of the planet. So in a rapidly urbanizing world where some close to 60% of the world's population lives in cities, and that number is growing by leaps and bounds all the time, we really need alternative forms of transportation, particularly in cities, if the places we live are going to remain, you know, habitable and healthy. And so it's kind of up to lawmakers, politicians, to take the initiative to create cities that are less hospitable to drivers and more hospitable to cyclists. What has been found in places like Northern Europe, where they've had success with this, is simply by removing parking, making free curbside parking difficult, making it inconvenient to drive cars, bicycle culture has been able to kind of thrive. And most people have discovered, including some motorists, to their surprise, that living in a cycling city is a lot more pleasant than living in a city packed, you know, chock-a-block with motor cars.
You mentioned health, and earlier I referred to the role of bicycles in the emancipation of women, and you have some entertaining excerpts from various publications in the 1890s. This one from the American Journal of Obstetrics and Diseases of Women and Children. A very grave objection, it says, has been made to the use of the bicycle among women, which, if true, would induce us to be exceedingly cautious in ever suggesting this exercise. It has been said to beget or foster the habit of masturbation, and so on and so forth. This horrible habit, it goes on to inveigh against it, and it suggests various postures that you could use to limit the danger. So yes, That's very funny, and it also indicates that the bicycle has followed us through in our kind of cultural development and evolution. Somebody else has said, I don't know whether you've ever been to Wellington, but it's hilly. And somebody says that a lot more bikes would be used in Wellington if they could iron out the hills. But you've said that Bhutan is planning on having a bicycling culture. And if Bhutan can do it, anyone can do it, surely.
Oh, that's for sure. Well, yeah, you know, there's a long history of people riding bikes up and down hills, you know, where certainly that's what we're seeing in certain stages of the Tour de France when these incredible athletes bomb up and down the Pyrenees. But in a city like Wellington, yes, it is very hilly. Certainly that's the case in American cities like San Francisco, Cisco as well. There are now wonderful bikes with gearing systems that can make going up those hills a little less difficult. And now, of course, we have the advent of the e-bike. And I think this is a really transformative moment for the bicycle in the kind of history of the bicycle. It's certainly, I think, the most important development in cycling technology since the advent of the safety bicycle in 1885. So in well more than a century, because the e-bike, these pedal assist bikes, can allow you to kind of zip straight up those hills, and then maybe you can go back to pedaling your bike on the way down or on flatter terrain. It's a wonderful new machine, which I think makes the bicycle a better utilitarian option, for instance, for people who commute to work, don't want to show up to their offices to the extent that anybody goes to the offices anymore post-pandemic. But if you don't want to show up at a meeting drenched in sweat, well, then grab an e-bike or ride an e-bike as opposed to an old-fashioned kind, as opposed to the old-fashioned acoustic motorbike, as Luca Bloom would have it. And you can get there looking your best. So there are solutions to these problems. But as you say, in Bhutan, in the Himalayas, the government there is very interested in turning that country into a cycling culture. So if they can do it in the Himalayas, surely we can do it. We can do it in Auckland or San Francisco.
The mention of e-bike, though, reminds us that there is no such thing as a free lunch, Jody. And, you know, there was... When rubber started being used a lot, we preferred not to think that it was coming from brutal colonial regime. And now there's lithium, which is something else to worry about. How do you really feel about electric bikes?
My feelings about electric bikes, I have to say, are personally ambivalent. Because I have ridden them a few times, but I like the old fashioned kind. I'm a middle-aged guy. So for the time being, I'm going to keep trying to pedal for as long as I can. It's a good way for me to keep in shape and keep me feeling young, no matter how I look. I might not look young anymore, but I feel young when I ride a bike. But in terms of the environmental impacts of the e-bike, yeah, certainly it is not as green a machine by any means as the old-fashioned traditional pedal-powered bike, purely pedal-powered bike. But it's definitely a far greener machine than any automobile, including an electric car, because cars are the largest net contributor to climate change conditions worldwide. And that is not just from pollutants that come out of the tailpipe, but it's even from things like pollutants that arise from the rubber tires on the road. So we got to do what we can in this world to help diminish the number of cars on the road. And I think the e-bike is a wonderful, one of many wonderful solutions to the problem of urban transport.
There's some lovely reportage in this book, Jody, including your account of the rickshaw wallahs in Bangladesh, in Dhaka, who work possibly the hardest of anybody in the entire world and have trouble keeping up their calories to cope with the exercise they're getting. One of the most exciting things I ever did was to take a rickshaw, a tricycle, not a bicycle, of course, a rickshaw ride through narrow back streets of an Indian city and watch them maneuver and fight each other for the space. It's the most extraordinary thing, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I spent a fair amount of time in Dhaka, which is the world's fastest growing and most densely populated megacity, the capital of Bangladesh. There's some 24 million people who live there. That number is growing astronomically all the time. Bangladesh, of course, is a country that's afflicted by climate change, perhaps worse than any other place in the world. There's erosion in the countryside, driving more and more rural people into the capital of Dhaka. So it's a city that's absolutely afflicted by the worst possible traffic woes you can imagine. It's a city with horrific infrastructure, and the only thing that really keeps that place going is pedal power. Are these cargo tricycles that both ferry goods and raw materials across the city and ferry passengers, because the passenger rickshaw, this three-wheeled kind of pedal-driven taxi, is akin to like the yellow taxi used to be here in New York before the advent of Uber. There are perhaps more than a million of them plying the streets of Dhaka. And as you say, it is an extraordinary sight to see them. The men who do this work are impoverished men who are extremely skilled at their jobs and who work under the most adverse conditions. But you know, one of the points that I tried to get across in the book is the fact that, you know, in places like New Zealand and the United States, often we tend to think of the bicycle as something like a lifestyle choice or a leisure device or a machine for sport. But in much of the world, it's a vehicle for labor and for livelihood. In China alone, there are between, according to one study, 40 and 60 million working cargo tricycles on the streets, ferrying goods here and there. That number is astonishing. That means that there are more cargo tricycles working in China alone than there are. That number exceeds the combined number of cargo boats, planes, trains, and trucks worldwide. So bicycles or pedal-powered devices, tricycles, are playing a much more crucial role in the workings of the global economy than we perhaps realize. And this is especially true if you look at the developing world and, you know, the so-called global south, the megacities of Asia, Africa, and Latin America, where you really see these bicycle cultures are central.
Excellent to talk to you, Jody, and thanks for the book, Jody Rosen, Two Wheels Good, The History and Mystery of the Bicycle.